easily takes an hour per patient to review a chart for a study to see if a patient is there. We can bring that down to a couple of minutes. That is all the more time they can spend with actual patients for recruitment. And that is the most important thing.
So what's very interesting about this is it's not just about one data type. It's about the plethora of multiple data types. And frankly, some of the traditional based data capture is not going away. So you have to actually harness the traditional methods and have a system that's capable of integrating that with the novel data collection. That's really what we're seeking to do in the future.
When we talk about burden, it's time, it's money, it's just exhaustion. So to be able to have somebody stay in their home, you don't have to find childcare. You don't have to take time off of work. We'll do a visit on the weekend. We'll do a visit in the evening. Things that make it easier for people to participate. And the more people that can participate, the faster we can develop new therapies for the broader population.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Welcome back. Clinical trials are the engine that drives medical innovation, but that engine has been sputtering for far too long. The traditional methods of patient recruitment and trial operations are no match for the complexity of modern research and the massive influx of innovation coming from new biotech, tech bio, and medical device companies. I'm Alex Merwin from AWS, and in this compilation episode, part three of our health innovation series, you'll hear from DeepSix AI, Locavant, and Science 37, who are reimagining how trials are conducted. If you missed the first two parts of this compilation series, make sure to check out our feed where you'll find part one, which focused on innovations in drug R&D, and part two on diagnostics and biomarkers. Each section starts with a brief introduction to the company, followed by an excerpt from their episode on the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you like what you hear and you want to hear more about any of these companies, please check out our show notes for a link to the complete episodes. Clinical trials innovation is a fascinating space, and I'm really happy with how this compilation turned out, and I hope you enjoy it too. Let's get into it. We welcome Wout Breseliers, the CEO and founder of DeepSix AI, to the show. We'll learn about their innovative and transformative approach to recruiting patients to clinical trials, and Wout's founder journey, including the important role Cedars-Sinai Accelerator had in developing their initial business thesis. AI is having a big impact across health innovation, and this conversation really brought to light how the technology is accelerating clinical research, not potentially, but right now, ultimately getting new medicines to patients faster. Let's go. Wout Breseliers, the founder and CEO of DeepSix AI. Thank you so much for joining me today on the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
So where are you joining us from?
I'm calling in from Pasadena, California, which is sometimes referred to as a suburb of Los Angeles. That's probably not doing it justice.
Yeah, fair. And where are you from originally? When did you move there?
I'm originally from Belgium in Europe, and I moved here close to 20 years ago. So it's been a long time. And I lived in Asia and the Middle East before. So I kept moving east until I found myself on the west coast of the US.
A true globetrotter. Yeah, I'm from Colorado and I moved to the UK in 2015. And I've always found it's useful to live in another country just to know that the way that you did it growing up isn't the only way to do things. Like you can't see all the world, but just knowing that there's another way is quite helpful, I find.
Exactly. Everything is contingent.
Yes, that's right. Well, wow, can you introduce us to DeepSix AI, who your customers are and what you all do?
Yeah, sure. So DeepSix AI, in a nutshell, de-risks and accelerates clinical research for hospitals or sites, life sciences companies, often referred to as sponsors, and CROs. So basically, we de-risk and accelerate clinical research for all the major stakeholders in that process. And we do this by connecting all of those study stakeholders that I just mentioned on a real-time clinical trials acceleration software platform, which uses AI to precision match patients to studies. So what it does to those clients or for those clients is it brings like much needed visibility and access to all the eligible patients for a study across an entire health system. And that is, as you can imagine, very different from how clinical trials traditionally operated, where it was much more a relationship game, right? Physicians reach out to patients that they happen to remember or they know, they're fresh in their mind. Sponsors reach out to sites where they have good relationships or they worked with in the past. So it's very much driven on a past history, again, contingency, right? And access to relationships rather than a true data-driven process. So we, by our ability to mine real patient data, which means all of the EMR data, including all of the physician notes, pathology reports, genomic reports, right? That's where our AI engine comes in, or the NLP. We offer a real-time view into how many eligible patients there are today at any given site. And that allows you then, once you have that view, once you have the visibility, it de-risks the centers and the studies that you work on, right? And it allows the research teams and the physicians at those sites to use those lists of screen-ready patients to start recruiting.
Great. I can't wait to get into the go-to-market a little later and to learn more about where you sell into and how you get distribution with the sites and the integrations to the EMRs. But just to start, can you give us an idea of where you have the most market segment penetration, whether you think about that in terms of geography or therapeutic area? Where are most of your studies conducted?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And let me start. Geography, we're operating in the US. Early on, we had a couple of clients in Australia, which was purely opportunistic. I wish I could say there was a big strategy to go to Asia Pacific, et cetera. We just ran into a maverick decision maker, a visionary actually at a CRO in Australia who helped bring us in there at a couple of sites. During COVID, they shut down research. We haven't really picked it up again because it was just small. But we've been growing very rapidly in the US. I think we can now say that we probably have one of the largest, if not the largest, ecosystems of leading academic medical centers with access to unstructured data. We can talk later about some of the names there. In terms of therapeutic area, we are by design agnostic. Our AI or platform mines all of the data, regardless of the disease type or therapeutic area. We can find patients for any trials, but we reflect the distribution of clinical research in the wild, right? Most of the money goes to oncology clinical trials. So you see many of our clients are leading cancer centers and we do a lot of studies there. Then there's cardio, there's neuro, there's rare diseases. We play everywhere. We're representative at this point of kind of how those studies are distributed in the wild. And that in terms of the different stakeholders, because in a way we're connecting all of these stakeholders, you could almost treat that as a marketplace, right? Where you have supply and demand. And in a way, the supply for us is those health systems. They're the ones who are executing on the clinical trials. It is their patients that are going into studies. And it is their data that we give to them, or we help them mine their data so they can actually find those patients. So we spend the first couple of years of our existence in selling to those major health systems. It was quite an arduous journey. I think it's not easy selling to health systems. They're very decentralized decision-making and tight budget. But I believe it's become a strength of ours. And we've been very successful selling into them. And that's why I think we have a leading role there. And now we're at that point in our journey where we have a big enough ecosystem that we can start selling into life sciences. And that's been more of our focus for this past year. Great success there as well.
That's great. We have a lot of different types of companies and founders on the show, but we have had a few who are focusing on driving innovation in the way that new therapeutics and diagnostics are clinically validated and brought to market. And I just think it's so important because we're really living in this golden age of innovation within biology, where we're truly gaining a very nuanced and detailed understanding of the many different omics. And as these foundation models come online and more companies are using them to identify novel drugs, unfortunately, it doesn't matter how tight we get with our patient stratification and how personalized we get with our therapeutics if we can't clinically validate it. And today, trials are just so grossly inefficient and expensive, it's a massive bottleneck. And this amazing innovation we're seeing in the lab, and driven by tech bio and computational biology, it won't get into the clinic. It won't get into the clinic unless we really rethink the way that clinical research is done. Hats off to you and what you and the team are doing. But maybe we can learn a little bit more about you as a person. So you've really had a fascinating career. You've worked as a diplomat, a consultant, a finance leader, a founder in a broad range of sectors. So intelligence, social commerce, now healthcare. Can you tell us more about your professional journey, especially the aha moment you had during your time at the Cedars-Sinai Accelerator and really what drove you and inspired you to focus on clinical trials?
Yeah, I wish I could say it's a very linear trajectory, but it was not at all, actually, probably to the despair of my parents early on. What are you going to do? I think I grew up in Europe and in what I call a very humanist society or background, right? We're very idealistic about the pursuit of knowledge and doing something meaningful, etc. And I read a lot, and I think I was influenced by many things. You have a lot of opportunity. There's many things you could be doing with your life. So picking the right thing to do is important. And as I said, by reading Octavio Paz and Jorge Semprún and many other writers that happen to be diplomats as well, I thought this is an amazing environment, right? For people who have an interest in the world, they want to be surrounded by smart people. You're at the center of politics and all of these things that are happening. So this is what I want to do. In reality, when I became a diplomat and actually went to the Middle East, I greatly enjoyed it at first. And there were many very interesting things about it. But it was a bit more bureaucratic than I had actually counted on. And maybe that was part of a self-discovery. I found out that I'm not the most patient person, or that I'm not that good in operating like in bigger structures where you don't have as much control and you're just a cog in the wheel. And as I was actually a diplomat, I met some people from consulting companies that basically asked me for some feedback on doing business in the Middle East, and say, hey, you should be a consultant. If you're interested in working with smart people, that's where today's smart people are. Join us and work there. So I did that, joined one of the big consulting firms, learned a lot. I thought it was fascinating, met a lot of indeed very smart people, but also felt like it was still a big structure. And the pure pursuit of shareholder value creation was not really enough for me. I wanted to do something more and have more of an impact. I wanted to have my hands basically on the steering wheel and be able to not just do planning and consulting, but also to execute. That led me to my next couple of steps, was helping turning around a physical security company that operated in Latin America and Africa and other parts of the world, which was very interesting. And through those connections with State Department and some other things, we were able to participate in a contest for the US government, which was basically unnamed, but open to a handful of select smaller companies and larger companies. We happened to win that contest, and it was really based on our ability to mine massive amounts of unstructured data. They gave us basically a large corpus, and they identified and said, can you figure out what the topics are there? So some advanced topic modeling, and assign a set of priority and ownership, who should look at what when. So we did pretty well there, beating out some much bigger names in what is now AI or machine learning and other sectors. We had some contracts with the government that came from that, were for a while bootstrapped, and we could have grown there. But I also realized that we were more a West Coast tech company than an East Coast government contractor. So decided to look for a different market, and taking the capabilities and skill sets that we had built up in dealing with massive amounts of unstructured data to a different industry. And because we wanted to do something meaningful and build a mission-driven company, that meant for us either healthcare or education, which both I think are meaningful pursuits, and they both deal with a lot of unstructured data, which I think you can use to provide a better service in each of them. Healthcare had the easier path and the greater market, and also was even a little bit closer to my heart still. So we ended up participating in the Techstars Cedars-Sinai Healthcare Accelerator Program, where we were suddenly exposed to over 300 physicians, nurses, administrators, payers, pharmas, researchers, basically everybody. And we had an ability to mine unstructured data, and we tried to quickly make sense of what is the best problem for us to solve. What do we do with this ability, right? And we got requests from, can you design a better EMR with $100 million in 3 years in Stealth? Yes, but that's probably not us, right? Can you find an algorithm to detect patients with sepsis? Which, yeah, maybe, but it's a pretty small and narrow use case, and we would be like a small plug in a better system. So we developed a framework that we applied to all these opportunities to say, where do we have a truly large total addressable market, right? Where is there a big market of opportunity that is still largely fragmented, where there's no clear winner, where our ability to mine that unstructured data allows us to have a 10x better outcome or product than others, right? And where we have a clear ROI story for our stakeholder or multiple stakeholders. And as we did that to stack rank the opportunities, it became clear that clinical trials was that big unsolved problem. That had a tremendously big market, and there was no clear winner. Most companies trying to address it were services companies. There was very little products trying to deal with it. And we did believe, because there were so many stakeholders, as I mentioned before, that there was a strong ROI for all of them if we could find that one solution that would connect those stakeholders and offer them more efficiency, faster recruitment with fewer dedicated resources, more de-risking of all the efforts they put into that research. And that's where we got started.
Hmm.
So wow, we have a number of people who listen to the show that are founding or thinking about founding new healthcare or life sciences startups. And there's a really interesting lesson and an important one in your story, which is focusing on something that has enough leverage to have impact, right? So you mentioned how you saw many different opportunities, but you really wanted to find something that could 10x the status quo. And I think that's really important because there's so much cost and change in healthcare. There's a lot of liability. It's very risk averse. Change carries a lot of risk with it. So it needs to be worth it. You really need to have a strong, compelling value proposition in order to make it worth driving the change within the organization. So maybe we can talk a little bit more about how patient recruitment was done before. Can you help draw a baseline of what patient recruitment looks like, how it works in a world without DeepSix AI's technology? And then we can talk a little bit more specifically about how your technology works, and feel free to go into however much technical detail you'd like. But yeah, it'd be good to learn about the baseline of how patient recruitment worked and how it works with your technology.
Yeah, I know that's a great question to start from indeed. So traditional clinical trial recruitment, right, hadn't changed very much from, say, the days of aspirin, where you develop one drug or one pill, you give it to anybody or everybody who has a headache or pain or a fever, and they all respond pretty well. Just find me any patient, put them on a study. And the way to do that is you ask physicians, which of your patients has complained about a headache? Can we put them on a study? Reach out to them the next time they come in, right? Or as we started digitizing more information, you try to find some of those patients through data-driven queries, right? Typically in relational databases, which can only find the structured data in healthcare, which is a very limited data set with very little granularity or nuance, right? So it at best gives you like a very big haystack of potential patients, but you still have to do manual chart review to see which of those patients meet all of the inclusion and exclusion criteria. And in a way that kind of sums up what most solutions up until some fairly recent ones have done, right? They try to build bigger haystacks. So if I'm trying to find patients for a study, let me try to find as many patients first, and then let's see which of those patients are actually eligible. Social media campaigns can say, okay, if you have prostate cancer, go to this website and click on this button, and then we will contact you, we'll ask you some questions, we'll see if you're eligible for the study. Or you work with more traditional media campaigns, or you do those query searches, right? In your database, you find any patient with, say, prostate cancer, and you find out which one has all of the other components of the study. What we try to do that's different is we really try, instead of building bigger haystacks, to only focus on the needles from the start. And the reason why is that over the years, clinical trials have become a lot more complex. Finding patients for aspirin is fairly easy because any patient, right, regardless of age, of gender or whatever, that has a headache, has a complaint, you can put them on a study. That is very different for some of these precision medicine drugs that require a very specific phenotype and genotype of a patient for them to work. You do not want to put your study at risk, but you have to submit data for the FDA to show what the efficacy and the safety was of your study if you actually targeted the wrong patient population. And that has negatively impacted the success of your drug on those patients. So you want to be laser sharp in which patient makes it onto your study, because they are the ones that are going to respond to the drug, and they're the ones that the FDA is going to look at to see, can we actually expand this to a wider market? So the way that we try to bring that precision to clinical trial recruitment, right, is, as I said, by looking at all of the patient data, not just the structured data, but also including all the much more nuanced data that is typically in physician notes, in pathology reports, in genomic reports, right? And in so many other places that traditional software cannot really mine. And what we do is we go and we work with those health systems that have all of that data that we spoke about before. We ingest all of that data actually onto our AWS cloud platform, right? Where we run all of those. We first go in for historical data, then we update that nightly, or in some cases we can update it in real time, depending on the data protocol that they use, right? Like FHIR HL7. And we turn all of that data for each patient basically into a vector that represents a patient. So we read the notes, we use NLP to find all the relevant clinical concepts in those notes, right? This is a symptom, this is a disease, right? This was a test, this was an outcome. And then we basically label those and reduce all of those texts, all of those notes, right? All of the fields in those relational databases, right? Into that patient vector. And they're then a sum, right? A multidimensional representation of all of those concepts. And those are now an ideal SOFA or subject of analysis. You can search against that. And then you can start from a protocol for clinical trial, with inclusion and exclusion criteria that says, find me all the patients with prostate cancer without neuroendocrine differentiation, right, who've shown up in the last 6 months for this test and who've had a radical prostatectomy or have this failed line of therapy and who do not have metastatic cancer and are not on this drug, right? So you can then actually use all of those criteria to mine those vectors and reduce them to those patients that are kind of precision matched to that protocol. Once you have that, and we can do that very quickly because we ingest all of the data in real time, it's searchable immediately in real time, right? You can now start from that precision cohort of needles or eligible patients, and you can then share that cohort with the research team so they can actually go and reach out, but you can also alert treating physicians who may not even be researchers, who may not even be at the same site, but they're part of your network, but maybe a couple of miles away from you, and you don't know them personally, and you didn't know their patients. But now you can ask those treating physicians if they can suggest your study to their patients. And we're actually doing that now inside of the EMR for a couple of clients. We're rolling it out inside of the Epic EMR so a physician can get a notification. Hey, Alex, the patient that you're seeing now about is eligible for the study. Here's information about the study. Are you okay referring them? So without trying to take up too much time from these valuable consult minutes that you have with a patient, we want to quickly bring a study to your attention, allow you to click and move on. That then allows the research team to reach out to the patient. Plus the patient can receive some information about the study themselves, and now they're interested as well. So again, it's that visibility into the needles, right? The patients are truly a match, and then access to those patients beyond just the PI themselves.
Today, we're speaking with Rohit Nambishan, president at Locavent, a company seeking to eliminate operational errors from clinical trials. Rohit shares his insights with Joe Schonkweiler on how technology can further enable drug development, why identifying internal challenges can be a potent innovation driver, and how clinical trial data is currently underutilized. Let's dive in.
Rohit Nambishan, president at Locavent. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a bit about Locavent and what you all do?
Sure. I think the first thing to say about Locavent is it didn't start out by intending to be a company. Really, I came to Roivant Sciences, which is Locavent's parent company at this point, about 3.5 years back. And the remit there was to look at novel ways to expedite development of therapies, primarily focused on Roivant's therapeutics under development across a variety of biotech subsidiaries. But I think the remit was really to think about how do we use technology and data in innovative ways to actually reduce the friction in drug development and expedite those therapies to address clinically unmet needs. And one of the things we realized very quickly, and this is based not only on my experience at Roivant, but also at former experiences at Novartis and other life sciences experiences, is that we're moving across the industry, at least in clinical research, into niche therapeutics development. And developing more complex niche therapeutics involves more complex things to test. And that means that there's novel data sources that are being generated to across a number of different trials and novel data systems. And frankly, you want to enable drug developers and the folks that administer trials on their behalf, CROs, sites, et cetera, you want to enable them to choose the systems they want to use so that you don't bring unnecessary risk to the study, but also you fit the data needs to the things you're trying to test for. The problem with that is that there's been legacy systems in place for years and years, data management and analysis for clinical trials that just cannot handle the kind of explosion of different data types that have been happening in the last few years, not to mention the last 24 months or so, the emergence of all these decentralized direct-to-patient type data capture systems. So what my team had realized at Roivant is we'd work with a number of different vendors and we were just not happy with the capabilities out in the market to represent what is going on reliably on the study on a day-to-day, so let's even say we do week-to-week, but on definitely on a day-to-day basis. I guess the analogy I'd use is you can spend $20 on ordering a pizza and you can know where it is along its chain of custody to you, and including when it was ordered, when you should anticipate it, and when it's going to arrive. And we spend $50 million to $300 million on per study, and we can't get a reliable signal on the screen failures, discontinuations, and enrollment across our clinical trial study sites. That's just egregious, in my opinion. So really, we came at this from the perspective we were not happy with what was out there in the market. And we decided, as lead user innovations will often take on a problem, that they're experiencing. And we decided to take that on and start building a solution internally at Roivant to address those problems. So really, it was an internal product at Roivant, or an internal platform for development at Roivant. And we started building this both in terms of being able to address data capture, so in connect, ingest, and map data from any source system. So we're data agnostic, thereby enabling choice, as I mentioned before.
Right.
On top of that, be able to create configurable and analytics across a spectrum of use cases, from things like site monitoring all the way to medical monitoring, so lab data monitoring and safety monitoring, and forecasting your enrollment. So a variety of different use cases, and had a lot of success at Bivance, or the subsidiary biotechs of Roivant. And at that point, some of the partners, CRO and other partners of Roivant, had reached out and said, hey, we'd like to think about collaborating with you outside of this. So we started thinking about, okay, what would that look like? And we realized we were on something. So in January of 2020, we externally launched Locavant to the market. And since that time, we spent a fair amount of time in R&D on the configurability use cases across analysis in clinical research. But now we have a full-fledged clinical, what we call a clinical intelligence platform. So it connects, ingests with maps from any data source, represents that information reliably so that you know what's going on a day-to-day basis across a variety of use cases I aforementioned. And the second, I think the third piece, second or third piece at this point would be, we've also collected a lot of data along the way.
Right.
That data, at least 2,000 studies and growing, allows us to do very unique, predictive, and sophisticated, proactive analysis that we can leverage and bring to bear with our partners and customers. And so on top of even reliably identifying the issues at hand and prior helping clinical operators and clinical developers prioritize those issues based on the risk inherent to those issues, we can also predict things before they occur. And so we've been racking up the use cases and the case studies on that ever since.
Wow. I'm really struck by the unique innovation story there between Roivant and Locavant, where there's a term that you're in, we'll get into this in a bit, I'm sure, with your product background, like eating your own dog food. Like, you were able to, in software development, where you identify a problem and then try to solve it and then use that solution to solve your own problem as a proof of concept. And so this is a real example of that. An internal, you were dog fooding, so to speak, the solution, and realize, hey, it's not just us. There's going to be others that have this problem, and there's a larger opportunity here. Is that accurate?
That's 100% accurate. I think the way I would put it is very similar. It's when we were at Roivant, we wanted to assess what are some of the significant and frequent challenges we're seeing across the diversity of studies and programs across the biotechs. And we also checked to see, before we externalize, whether those are significant and frequent problems outside of Roivant. And obviously, the biotech market, biopharma market is much bigger than Roivant. And if we are experiencing these problems, it's very likely, and we can address them uniquely, it's very likely that there's a big market opportunity out there. And so we weren't trying to predict or create solutions in search of a problem. We were experiencing the problem firsthand, built towards it, and then started generalizing for the broader market thereafter.
And for you personally, being so instrumental in this effort, talk me through, A, like your background, like what were you've lived at that intersection, it sounds like, between life science, technology, and I want to understand why, like, how were you uniquely positioned to do this as you were standing up Locavant from the Roivant universe?
So I guess the first thing to say about my background is I'm actually a neuroscientist by training. So I spent about 10 years in academic and clinical research. The latter half of that time was focused on what I would call applied neuroscience or computational neuroscience. I guess biomimetic robotics, computer vision, neural nets, things that are within the vein, I suppose, of artificial intelligence, although that those two words are often misused, but I think it's within the vein of that. And one caveat to that is, throughout my experience, I've found that neuroscientists, especially systems-oriented neuroscientists, which is most of my training, make really good product people, because you actually think about the world both in terms of integration and modularity, right? So you have to think about individual systems and what goes on in those individual systems to create that emergent behavior, that system itself, those modules, right? But you can't get too focused at also on just solving for a single system. You have to think about how that system, single system, interacts with multiple other systems to create emergent behavior. And so that is essentially I think, at least, the right process when you're actually leading product management efforts, because they're complex socio-technical systems that all have their modules, and they have to work in concert to produce this very complex, but also ideally very simple to the user and intelligent behaviors. So that's just in terms of my background academically and research-wise. I spent a number of years at Novartis in their Theranostics or Personalized Medicine group, which is my intro to industry at that point, and also had experience thereafter in their Oncology Global Development group and then the commercial group for a little while. So that was eye-opening. I got my first taste of really what drug development is like and the regulatory concerns, et cetera. Right. Went actually in front of the FDA for a few submissions during that time. That was a very interesting experience, first job going and presenting to the FDA a few times. It was definitely a learning experience. I think one thing that's clear about me is I'm not a big fan of large corporate culture. And so over the next number of years, I went from smaller company to smaller company and then found my stride in startups. I just, to fill in the gap there, spent some time in health IT at a medium-sized company, developing systems to test for meaningful use. What I think that's interesting about health IT is they figured out at that point the data connectivity for basically passing large amounts of patient relevant, patient-oriented data back and forth, maybe not for product development purposes of data analytics, but definitely for patient treatment operations. And at the time that I was in life sciences and at my Novartis time, that wasn't very mature. The idea of real-world data, bringing data in from other sources to optimize product development wasn't very mature. Consequently, thereafter, I went into a startup that was life sciences-oriented after their leading product, and literally leveraging lab data and claims data and all these other real-world data sources to support commercial analytics for life science companies, launched a pairs franchise, et cetera. But suffice it to say, I've now been at a few startups, a leading product or business development, and before coming to Roivant and what I did at Roivant thereafter.
That's great. Yeah, no, the neuroscience piece in particular is underappreciated. I had never thought of that analog. The privilege of learning the principles of neuroscience from Dr. Eric Kandel when I was in medical school. And the interlocking systems piece highlights that. He's highlighted that throughout his research. Yep. And the modularity, like the whole that he won a Nobel Prize for working with giant sea slugs, aplysia, and the whole concept that there are modules that are conserved throughout evolutionary biology that exist in sea slugs that teach us about memory retention and long-term memory in humans is a great example of that. Yeah, what a fantastic. I'd never thought of that analog, but I think it fits really well for a lot of the stuff that you're doing now.
Yep, definitely. And I think I used Kandel's textbook, and I think at the time,
yeah,
I had heard him speak about the aplysia case study as well.
But anyway. That's great.
The commute, the time, the cost. Now imagine a shift, a change that brings these cutting-edge therapies into the comfort of patients' homes. Darcy Foreman, the Chief Delivery Officer of Science 37, joins us today to dive deep into how the clinical trial landscape is evolving. You'll discover how Darcy and her team are meticulously working to bridge logistical gaps in clinical trial delivery, all while keeping patient centricity at the heart of their operation. Here we go. Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Darcy Foreman, who's the Chief Delivery Officer of Science 37. So maybe, Darcy, just to kick off, tell me a little bit about Science 37 and what y'all do.
Absolutely. Alex, thanks for having me today. So at Science 37, we're really trying to bring clinical trial access to anybody that wants to participate in trials. So currently and historically within clinical trials, if physicians become investigators and investigators are involved in clinical trials, and they're pulling from their patient populations to enroll in studies. As the industry has evolved, additional investigators or those physicians have become involved, but there's still a huge amount of patients that are never provided an opportunity to participate in clinical trials. They might live far away from a key opinion leader or a specialized investigator or physician, but they still have disease and they still have healthcare needs. And so Science 37 is really trying to democratize clinical trials by bringing clinical trial opportunities to the patients. We have a network of our own investigators, our own mobile nurses that will travel to the patient instead of that patient having to assume the burden of traveling. It's all based on the use of technology. We couldn't do what we do if we didn't have a technology backbone that lets us execute the trials the way that we do. So it's really about providing opportunities for trials and clinical research as a care option for people that normally or historically have not received the opportunities.
I just think it's amazing the work you're doing, and I can relate to it because my family has struggled to find trials that are a good fit for our needs. My nephew, he has autism, he's 9, he presents with ADHD symptoms, he's had a little bit of trouble at school, and he's been prescribed with Ritalin. But my sister, she's a bit concerned because there's some literature about long-term use of Ritalin and adverse effects. And because the symptoms are related to his ASD, they're not likely to go away. It's just part of who he is. And so they've tried to find clinical trials for new therapeutics, but it's been a real struggle to find ones that they can travel to. You know, given their family and obligations, it's just not practical. So tell me a bit more if you're focusing on any specific therapeutic areas and generally how your solution makes it easier for a particular patient population to access a trial that they otherwise wouldn't be able to.
Yeah, we really are trying to continue to expand what therapeutic areas we can execute in, but we really want it to be agnostic to therapeutic areas. We have run studies in pediatrics. Your nephew is a perfect, you know, in addition to the burden that it has on the family and just even finding those opportunities. If you think about these patient populations that sometimes can be very uncomfortable leaving their home or be triggered by certain activities in foreign environments, keeping them in a comfortable location in their home and bringing a trial to them, it's prime. So again, pediatrics, and I hope we can find a trial opportunity or treatment options for your nephew. But we can do everything with chronic diseases, so diabetes, obesity. Again, some very prevalent diseases can also benefit. It really should be about everybody having an opportunity and an ease of participation. So we've enrolled patients as young as infants, and we've also enrolled a 99-year-old with macular degeneration. And, you know, there's this bias that elderly populations may struggle with technology, but we just take our time and get them through it. And they were able to do all of their clinical trial visits on our technology platform with just a little added help. So it's really about everybody. When I say it's about everybody, it's really about everybody.
So I would love to hear about an example or two, right? Because the thing is, our healthcare system is too often exclusionary for the people who need it the most. So can you talk about a few trials that you've done where, you know, you've really taken steps to ensure that the trial is accessible to patients from underserved or otherwise diverse backgrounds?
Absolutely. So again, we've done some really broad population-based studies, and we find that we're enrolling populations that match the census data. So we are drawing into those communities that, again, are underserved historically in clinical research. So we have large population studies where, you know, 56% of the patients enrolled in the trial for a colorectal study were of Black or brown skin colors and tones. And that's different than what you're going to get in a traditional model. So we're seeing a really high diversity pull just by the nature of providing access and giving that reach. But then we have some very specialized rare disease studies. One study that I'm incredibly proud of is oncology treatment study. It happened to be in the prime of COVID pandemic. These are immunocompromised breast cancer patients that needed their treatment every 3 weeks. They don't want to travel into a hospital setting to get an infusion. The sponsor was working on transitioning the dosing from an infusion to a injection. So it was a little bit easier to do in the home. And we were able to support those patients every 3 weeks with dosing in the home, but continuing to care and check for adverse events and keeping their care in line. And these patients developed such a strong rapport with our nursing team that by the end of the trial and the end of all of these dosing, there was like actual relationships. And we had patients giving cupcakes to their nurses on the last visit, thanking them for being able to help them continue with their treatment without having to travel during a pandemic and keeping them safe. So we have examples like that. We did a postpartum depression study where, you know, new mothers who are struggling with postpartum depression are receiving treatment in the home with an infusion. It was a 60-hour infusion, but it's keeping these patients, these mothers, these new mothers with their newborn child in their home while also providing them with the treatment and the care that they need to get through a difficult time for them. And so it's, again, it's clinical trials. It's all still in the experimental phase from investigational product and drug development perspective, but it's helping patients. And I'm very fortunate in my role to be able to hear these stories on a daily basis of patients that are truly thrilled to be able to have these opportunities that they wouldn't have if they had to go into a hospital setting, or it just would be too much for them to handle.
My heart is warmed and my stomach is growling hearing about the cupcakes. Yeah.
Yeah. I was a little jealous. I saw a photo of them and they looked top notch for sure.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, these people were being welcomed into their homes, right? So, and I love showing, not telling. So something I wanted to talk to you about was your Metasite. And that this is a really great example of that. So what is the Metasite? How does it work? How's it different?
Yeah. We compare it to a traditional site. So I'm going to start on the traditional site, which was a brick and mortar facility, like a doctor's office. There's an investigator, which is typically a physician, research nurses, and clinical research coordinators. And patients go into those facilities, interact with all three of those individuals, potentially receive their drug, get lab tests, get assessments done. But they're driving. Those patients are driving in and out to those physicians' offices. The Science 37 Metasite is really a site without walls. So we do everything through our technology. Our technology is used by the patients. It's used by the investigators. It's used by the nurses and those clinical research coordinators. And again, it's the backbone of what we do. So as soon as a patient or a participant is interested in a clinical trial, they'll download the Science 37 application onto their phone. They don't have to get an additional device or carry multiple devices around. So we make it very easy for them to participate. And then everything is walked through, you know, technology wise. We do workflow orchestration. The patient knows exactly what's going to happen. And all of the study visits that would normally happen in a brick and mortar facility, we typically do in the comfort of a patient's home. And so the nurse is really the only one that is co-located with that patient during the trial visit. Science 37, again, distinguishing factor, we have our own investigators with broad licensure, so we can cover a patient in 50 states. Same with nursing, like there's nursing licensure rules. So for us to be able to do patient care in the home, the nurse has to have a license in the state that the patient resides. We have our own nursing team. They all have 50 state licensure as well. So when we say we can support a patient anywhere, we can, and we do it with our own core set of team members that know exactly how to run clinical trials and how to do it in this kind of decentralized virtual model way. So we'll take any clinical trial, not any, but we take a lot of clinical trial protocols and we figure out how to deliver those trials in the home.
Darcy, I want to take a step back and learn a little bit more about you. What did you do before Science 37 and what brought you to your current position? And I'm asking that now because what you just described is really hard, right? And you articulated it great, right? I mean, it's a virtual site without walls where the patient can engage through a single point of contact and they can stay in the comfort of their own home and they can participate in studies. Yeah. But you have to have the distribution on the clinical delivery side. You need to have the technology in order to be able to deliver a really streamlined experience. The technology needs to be modular enough to be compliant and to be auditable. So I'm sure that as Science 37 evolved, that didn't all happen at once, right? Things happen in serial. So I'm hoping to hear about your background, what you've done before the company, and how that merged together with Science 37's evolution.
Yeah, no. So I started as a bench scientist at Pfizer. I knew I wanted to do research. I was drawn to science from a young age. So I was very fortunate to find a lab position at Pfizer. I was fortunate to get into a clinical trial training program within Pfizer. So I was able to learn about clinical trials and transitioned into a project manager role with our study manager role with at Pfizer. So I was learning clinical trials. And from there, my career has just progressed. I moved into the clinical research organization space. So I moved into the service provider space and spent a lot of years as clinical project manager, director, senior director, and moved my way up through multiple organizations. The organization I was prior to Science 37 was my first exposure, if you will, to clinical trials being done in an alternative way. And so I was at Firma Clinical Research. It's a niche organization that's doing home healthcare support for clinical trials. So they were just doing the mobile nursing activities to support trials. And so that was where I really opened my eyes to there's a different way for trials to be run. When I knew it was time for me to move on, I was fortunate to meet the CEO of Science 37, David Coman, and he and I just connected. And I talked about my passion for doing clinical research, but also this new way of doing it. And it just was somewhat, I pinch myself every single day because I'm able to bring classic clinical operations experience with this innovative spirit of doing something different. And this industry needs something different. It's been stuck for a long time, and patients and drug development are suffering as a result. I personally feel that way. So it is, I've been here for 3.5 years. It's been a roller coaster of a ride. It is hard, but so fulfilling. And I've never been in a place or been in a position where I feel like this is absolutely everything that I wanted. And I know that sounds so corny, but I feel so passionate about what we're doing and what we're trying to do to change the industry. And we hit roadblocks and we're solving problems every single day and we're doing hard things, but we're succeeding. But that doesn't mean we're not stubbing our toe every once in a while either, but it's so fulfilling. And so that's my path, and I'm just fortunate to be here.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast for part 3 of our 5-part mini-series focused on health innovation. In the coming weeks, we'll feature clinician and patient experience and real-world evidence, data, and population health. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss our latest episodes. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.